on the programme, remembering writer and historian Tony Judd and Robert Silvers, editor of the New York Review of Books, on his life in publishing. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight and a programme on the English-born historian Tony Judd, originally broadcast in late 2010, not long after his death. This year, 2013, also marks the 50th anniversary of the first edition of the New York Review of Books, to which Tony Judd was a regular contributor. And later in the programme, Robert Silvers, co-founder and editor of the review, stays on to discuss his life in publishing. First, though, to Tony Judd and his book The Memory Chalet, a collection of his writing originally published in the New York Review of Books. It contains many poignant, meticulous pieces detailing Judd's last years as he became increasingly debilitated by motor neuron disease. Judd is considered one of the finest historians of the late 20th century, but as is clear from his more personal prose writings, he was a hugely gifted writer who might well have chosen to follow that path in his life. Joining me to consider the life and work of the late Tony Judd are Fintan O'Toole, writer and commentator, Robert Silvers, editor and founder of the New York Review of Books, and Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University and co-author with Judd of the book Thinking the 20th Century. Before we talk to all of you, let's hear a little from Tony Judd himself from BBC Radio 3's Night Waves programme. Here he is talking about his book Ill Fares the Land.
I think that what I tried to write in the book was a sort of plea to reopen the sort of ethical conversation about what kind of society we want to live in. Not a conversation about how to be efficient, how to be wealthy, how to succeed, how to improve GDP, or how to achieve goal A, B, or C, but how to imagine a better society. Now for that we need institutions, we need policies, but above all, we need to be able to understand what it is we want. We can't do that if we can't think about it, we don't have the language. So I'm trying to encourage the resurgence of an ethical language of politics.
The voice, the words of the late Tony Judd there. Fintan O'Toole, remind us who Tony Judd was and why his writing, why his work is so significant.
Well, I suppose, firstly, people will have known him as the premier historian of post-war Europe. His great work, which I suppose is the one that will certainly stand, is called Post-War, and it is an absolutely awe-inspiring synthesis which brings together the stories of pretty much every European country between 1945 and the late 1990s. I think why it's really important to talk about him now and why these two books that came out of his last months, really, Ill Fares the Land, which he was talking about there, and The Memory Chalet, why those books are important, I think, is because they address an incredibly important moment, not least for us in this country. And they address it both in terms of that sort of broad idea of trying to discuss the ethical and moral foundations of politics, but also actually trying to, in a way, reconnect with his own experience. When he wrote Post-War, clearly he was shaped by the experience of having grown up in austerity Britain. One of the wonderful essays that he has in The Memory Chalet is about austerity and about the idea of austerity, which, of course, is an idea that we're hearing about every day on the news in Ireland. And one of the really important things that Judd draws attention to is that austerity wasn't just about having to queue up to buy powdered eggs. It wasn't just about poverty. It was a public ethic. And it was a public ethic which was about, you know, not having room for excess, but also about a moral seriousness in focusing on what you could do and what the aims of a society should be, even and perhaps especially in periods when it had limited resources. And I think, obviously in Ireland, we have a very immediate connection with that. But I think for the world in general, the idea of more limited resources is a particularly timely one. And actually, Judd's brilliant ability to link his own experience, his enormous knowledge as a historian, and that sense of, where we stand as a species in a way, that I think is unique. I don't think there's anybody else who has quite that same combination.
Robert Silvers, editor of the New York Review of Books. When did you first come into contact with Tony Judd and what are your early memories of him?
Well, I came in touch with him when he came back from the West Coast where he was teaching to NYU and he started the Remark Institute were named after Eric Maria Remarque, the author of the All Quiet on the Western Front, who had been married to Paulette Godard. And she quite unexpectedly left her rather large amount of money for this institute that Tony presided over. It was a most exceptional assembly of writers, thinkers, philosophers, political theorists who were trying to work out, do original work and take on original themes. And there was nothing quite like it in New York, and he assembled it, and it was a marvelous thing. And he first wrote for us in the early 90s, and I sent him a book about wartime Paris and collaboration, and the whole question of how people reacted to the persecution of Jews during World War II. And there we saw one of the great themes that run throughout his work, which is the question of moral blindness, moral fallibility, moral weakness when faced with a challenge. And he talks about how the some of the Jews, for example, who had survived the occupation after the occupation were so, in a way, tense and evasive about their Jewishness that they found themselves wrapped up in highly compromising communist causes, communist regimes, and communist collaboration. This is a major theme in Tony's work, and because, he, after all, he started out as a great historian of France and of the French political system, and above all, in his book, Past Imperfect, how the French intellectuals, after World War II, faced with what they must have understood were the persecutions of communism, whether in Eastern Germany or Eastern Europe or in Russia itself, were so anti-American, so obsessed with the specter of American domination that they sought, that they turned a blind eye to the post-war cruel, torturing trials of actual communists who they'd known. And so a question of good faith, of bad faith, of facing up to moral realities and obligations, these run throughout all of Tony's work, including that great book Fintan O'Toole referred to.
Tell me about The Memory Shelley, this fine new collection of his writings, most of them published by yourself, and now forming this book which has come out after his death.
He called them feuilletons. He was immobilized. He suffered from HLS, ALS, what we call Lou Gehrig disease, what the French call la maladie de Charcot, which means you are totally immobilized, can't move a finger. Just the lungs were able to function by a special pump, therefore allowing him to talk. But otherwise, he would lie there at night absolutely, rigidly immobile, not able to scratch. And many, many memories flooded through his mind, and Tim Gartner suggested he try to concentrate on them and write about them, and they, one after another, recollections and reflections on everything from his early days in Putney and Kingston as a little Jewish boy who was very English, who was drawn, as Tim put it, to the little pubs and shops and chuntering local trains of London at the time. At the same time, behind him, his father from Belgium and his many, many ancestors from Eastern Europe who were, in fact, refugees from the East, and with their own food and their own traditions, and he facing forward into English life where he miraculously went through from a local state school and got into Cambridge.
One detail that stays with me among many in the book is in the title essay, The Memory Shelley, when he says, reading his small leaves of prose, I am struck by the man I never became. That is a man who might have studied literature, poetry in particular. And he says, I do think something was lost. Was there at all something of a lost poet or committed prose writer in the eminent historian?
You can't deny that on reading the memory chalet. These are beautifully composed, often poetic memories and reflections of bits of life, ranging from trains to the personality of Milos to the mountains of Switzerland. These were highly evocative, beautifully composed essays, which show that in part of Tony's makeup was a particularly fine sensibility, which was of deeply literary. And some of his best writing, most moving writing, is on Albert Camus, who he saw as one of the few modern minds and modern actors in politics and in modern challenges of the conventional wisdom that he admired. And we see in this rapport with Camus both the moral and the literary affinities of Tony.
Let's talk about his childhood and his political formation and bring in Professor Timothy Snyder. And I imagine all of this will form an important part of your forthcoming book with him, Timothy. Tell us about his background growing up Jewish in London.
Well, as Bob quite rightly suggests, to understand Tony, one has to uncover layer after layer after layer. So at the end of his life, Tony is this very prominent, in effect, American intellectual who uses we, who uses the first person to describe himself when speaking to other Americans. And then just underneath that, you have a kind of French historical polemicist, someone who studied as a postgraduate student in Paris, imbibed the spirit of the École Normale Supérieure, who spoke French very well, and whose engagement with French history was and with the left, as Bob has also pointed out, was very personal. And then underneath that, you have the English Tony, the Tony who finished Cambridge, the Tony who finished Cambridge with a coterie of other wonderful historians, many of them, like himself, people who did not come from an elite background, who, by one way or another, made their way through grammar schools, which were not seen as elite and which are now forgotten. And then underneath the English Tony, there's the Jewish Tony, the Tony raised by parents who wanted for him to assimilate, but of course didn't quite have the means to bring that to completion, if such a project can ever really be completed. But then running through it all is the East Europeanness, because Tony's background on both sides, if you go back a couple of generations, is East European. And there was that tension in his childhood between becoming English and becoming that fine English prose writer, which he thought his school should take the credit, and the Jewish boy with Jewish parents who faced anti-Semitism at school. And that Jewishness found a couple of outlets. The first of them was his youthful Zionism. He was a committed Zionist as a young man. And the second, more subtle and more interesting, was the way that he found a route back to Eastern Europe, which had a lot to do with Jews who had a similar background in a way to his own, people born at around the same time, the late 1940s, who found themselves expelled in one way or another from Eastern Europe under communism, and whom he befriended and from whom he learned about Eastern Europe. And I think by way of Eastern Europe and East European intellectuals, he found other ways to talk about his Jewishness, more subtle ways and more interesting ways.
I suppose you could say he had a love affair with America, New York in particular, while in no way being blindly romantic about that country. How important was his engagement with America? How important was it to his writing, Timothy?
I think it was incredibly important in three broad ways. One is simply infrastructural. The Remark Institute and NYU gave Tony a kind of platform which he might not have had otherwise, which he might not have had he remained in Europe. The second was in terms of his own identity. America became another layer. He became an intellectual in the European sense, someone who wanted to improve. But what he wanted to improve was the United States. And his most passionate writing towards the end, in the last 20 years, let's say, had to do with American engagements, be they Iraq or Israel. And the third way that America was important to him was that America was a great project, which in some sense is still in the making. And so although his concern with social democracy, as Fenton rightly points out, comes from European experiences, and the historical book is about Europe, towards the end of his life, and in the book Ill Fares the Land in particular, he's concerned also with the future of the United States, on the understanding that here is a country which might yet still be reformed.
Fenton, can we talk about his book post-war from 2005, that book on European history since 1945? What broadly are its themes, and why is it regarded as having such importance?
Well, I think its importance, firstly, I suppose, is that for all the reasons we've been talking about, there are very few other people who would have had the breadth of knowledge to write it. You know, that it's the detail in the book that ranges from how many people were using trains in Czechoslovakia in 1947, you know, to the enormous architecture of the Cold War and everything in between, that really just makes it an absolutely astonishing book. But I think thematically, you know, what he sets down really is something that again is of enormous resonance for us here, which is what happens to a culture, an entire culture, if you can call Europe a single culture, in many ways it is, when it has reached the abyss, when it has destroyed itself, both morally and physically. And how does it then attempt to rebuild institutionally, culturally, psychologically? And the story he tells is a story that's actually compounded of skepticism. I mean, he has that sort of skill and mentality that every great historian has, which is to be skeptical of his sources, to be skeptical of the claims of ideologies, and passion. You know, that it's informed by an enormous sense of the possibility of change. Again, you know, we've just been talking about his idea of changing the world, changing America, and his admiration for the possibility of reinvention in Europe, I think, comes through the book. And I think there's a phrase very early on in the book where he talks about post-war Europe as a sort of glorious edifice built on a rotten past. And that perhaps sums him up perfectly. You know, he never, ever loses sight of the rottenness. He never loses sight of the capacity for self-delusion. He never loses sight of the justificatory rhetoric used by intellectuals to justify the unjustifiable. But at the same time, he does have an enormous beating pulse of admiration for the ability of those societies in different ways to construct institutions that he does see as having a moral core. And I think this goes back to that clip that you played at the very start. You know, that what he argues in relation to social democracy is, of course, that it was about management, that it was about attempting to rebuild societies. But he talks about it very much, and it's beating all the way through it, is this idea that what lay at its heart was a project which was really about containment. It was about containing the excesses of the free market and containing the damage that might be done by simply allowing a kind of a naked form of capitalism to run riot.
Let's hear another extract from Tony Judd on that BBC Nightwaves interview. Here he is talking about the 1960s.
Someone once said to me, your book is an attack on the 60s, but I'm very conscious that my generation, the baby boom generation, not only had it easy, that's a cliche, I know that, but that we very particularly unraveled many of the rather firm, perhaps over-firm, nostrums of the generations before us. That we replaced them with nothing very much except an enthusiasm for individualism, for letting the self achieve whatever goals it set itself. And the paradox, of course, therefore, is that it was the 60s left which is substantially responsible for breaking down the confidence in collective ideas, collective ambitions, collective institutions, which the old left had built up 20 years before.
The voice of Tony Judd. Robert Silvers, what was he like to work with?
Well, Tony was one of the most reciprocal and most friendly and most exciting people to work with. He would, in the matter of these feuilletons, for instance, he would just send me an email saying, another one is coming, and he would and I would read it, and I might have something to say about it. Whatever one said to Tony in a editorial way, he took very seriously. He practically always responded to it. He practically always, if one had some point to make, he always did something about it. And yet he was absolutely firm on the core of argument and the core of reflection that meant something to him. So he was he was a tremendously productive man. These feuilletons came out, I just think, from the an entirely immobile body, but an active mind, one after another, at a time when most people would probably be living in a state of simple despair. He wouldn't do that. And his whole life, I think, was a very much based on an unflinching recognition of reality. He, and this runs throughout his work. When Tim's mentioned he was a Zionist, he was a Zionist. He went to Israel. He was on a kibbutz. He was offered, while on the kibbutz, he was offered a chance to go to Cambridge. His fellow kibbutzniks frowned on it. He left. It was a big experience for him. He went his way. In the matter of the great book that Fintan was discussing, he brought to bear for the first time on the whole post-war history of Europe the experience of the East, of the Eastern nations, who people thought of them as simply under communism. He showed what had happened, and he, this idea of Europe as somehow Western Europe was not for him. It was all of Europe. And this was this unflinching look at what people were in generally turned their sight from. That was very much part of Tony's perspective.
Timothy Snyder, as his health deteriorated, you and he, between you, completed another book, Thinking the 20th Century, which is due out next year. Tell me what it was like working with him in that past year, and tell me about that book.
Yes, well, when you ask Bob about what it was like to work with Tony, it's important to keep in mind, as Bob has suggested, the physical reality of it, which is that beginning in the autumn of 2008, he could no longer use his hands or his arms. And that's the moment when I had the idea for what became Thinking the 20th Century. I thought of Tony's mind as something like a natural resource and that oughtn't to be wasted. And I thought of Tony as a friend, and Tony had helped me on a number of occasions, and he'd always said, you know, you can't pay me back, but you can pay back the next generation. And I thought, this might be an occasion where perhaps I could help, if only a little bit. And the little way that I helped was that I suggested to Tony that we do a book that would be a spoken book. And this is a tradition, as Tony knows or knew, that was very strong in Eastern Europe. The first book that Tony ever read in Czech from beginning to end were Karel Čapek's Conversations with Masaryk, the interwar Czechoslovak president. And the proposal was that we would meet once a week and we would talk through his books. And we would record those conversations, and I would edit them, and in the end, there would be a book. And at the beginning, the assumption, sad though it is to remember, was that we might get through the conversations, but that would be as far as we would go, because Tony's health was deteriorating very quickly. We went from a situation where he couldn't use his hands and arms to a situation where he was bound in a wheelchair and breathing by way of this apparatus that Bob mentioned, and only really able to use his voice. We got to that very quickly. And it seemed as though the deterioration was going to continue. In fact, we got all the way through the conversations, meeting once weekly for about half a year for several hours. I got all the way through editing the transcripts, and the two of us got all the way through revising those edited chapters into a final book. The form that the book takes is an interesting one, and I hope an effective one. It's an intellectual history of the 20th century, which is a book that Tony had always meant to write. And I should say that our conversations, although they started with my questioning him about his books, went off in two further directions. One of them was biographical. As Bob mentioned, Tim Garton-Ash and other friends of Tony's, such as Marcy Shore, suggested that he ought to try to concentrate on the biographical. And so we began to talk about biography. And the third direction was this book he wanted to write. He wanted to call it Modern Republic of Letters, an intellectual history of the 20th century. And so having talked about his prior books, having talked about his life, we also talked our way through all of the chapters of this book that he meant to write. Having had all those conversations, we then together formed them into a book, which has a series of thematic chapters on everything from the Jewish question to Zionism, to social democracy, to French intellectual life, to what it means to be an intellectual, what it means to be a historian, all of the great questions of the 20th century. Each of those substantial chapters is introduced by a fragment of Tony's life, which in some way speaks to the substantial issue. So the chapter about Zionism and the nation, for example, is introduced by Tony's experience as a Zionist. The chapter about French intellectual life is introduced by his time in France. The chapter about what it means to be a historian is introduced by a discussion of post-war, and so on.
It's extraordinary to think of him doing that work while suffering from motor neuron disease. And he seems to have borne all that suffering with incredible grace and determination of purpose. Here he is talking about the constraints of his illness.
I mean, I'm talking to you, as I said, from New York. I'm lying on the bed. I'm completely immobile. I'm speaking through a sort of air contraption which enables me to breathe. And so I'm merely a sort of mummified, disembodied head. But having said that, and not in the least complaining about it, since there's nothing I can do about it, so complaint is pointless, it does have a kind of liberating dimension. It means that I can think free of my physical circumstances. Now, I realize that most people can't, so if I try to imagine a world free of physical circumstances, I'm being very unrealistic. And it's not an account of anything that actually exists for most people. But in my slightly odd world, I've had this motor neuron disease for 18 months now. I really do live inside the sort of virtual space of my own head. And that means that I'm both a prisoner in a body which is steadily shrinking in terms of its capacities and will eventually constrict me to death. But I'm also completely free to think and talk and imagine and argue unrestrained by the usual physical limitations. It goes both ways.
Tony Judd on BBC Radio 3's Night Waves programme in April this year. He died in August. Robert, he wasn't religious, but he did talk about living on in the memory of the people who loved him as the only kind of afterlife he recognised. And in the memory chalet, this particular train journey in Switzerland also becomes a kind of image of transcendence, of a possible eternal bliss of sorts.
Well, that's a very fascinating that Tony loved trains and he thought of Switzerland as a very special place with many institutions that were, he thought, promising and of interest. And finally, in the mountains, he felt a peculiar freedom. And the combination of the little train going around its route high in the Swiss mountains was particularly appealing to him. It seemed allegorical in a way of a kind of ethereal future of some sort. But at the other end of his spiritual life, you might say, was something that he wrote in one of his most moving essays called Tony. It was about a Eastern European relative of his, after whom he was named, and who died in a camp. And he talked about Jewishness in this essay, and it was not, as he said, a religion for him. It was not otherworldly at all, but it was a collective experience in which people who had been in many ways persecuted or in an awkward relation to the majority nevertheless stood for certain values. And that for him was the kernel of the kind of Jewishness that he was committed to. It was a kind of Jewishness of moral memory and moral obligation. And so that is the, in one might say, a counterpart of the allegorical round of the little Swiss train high in the mountains.
Timothy, is there anyone else like him writing now or engaged in politics?
No, sadly not, which was why it was so clear to me that he ought to keep writing, and why I was so glad that he did. To echo what Vinton said, no one else could have written post-war, and I would go so far as to say that it's very unlikely that anyone is going to bring to bear that sort of range, sympathy, and sheer industry anytime soon. History is generally spiraling off into the fragments of specialization. Tony had the amazing capacity to bring together and to respect in this way the work of thousands of specialists to write a synthesis which on the one hand was conventional because its aspirations were to write about the whole, but on the other hand was incredibly innovative because it treated the whole as being composed not just of Western Europe, as Bob says, but also Eastern Europe, but also as comprising all of the societies, North and South, as well as East and West, and reaching from military history all the way to literary history. I'm afraid I think it's very unlikely that anyone is going to reach for that, let alone attain it, anytime soon. And in politics, and I can only speak from how it felt in America, Tony had the particular ability to understand what the governing assumptions of any given moment were without at all being governed by them. So he knew what was washing over us, and yet he was able to stand against it in an articulate way which people could follow. There are very few voices like that now, and I'm afraid his was special.
Vinton, mentioning literary history, it was striking that Judd turned to Goldsmith for the title of the book Ill Fares the Land, that great line, Ill Fares the Land to hasten ill a prey where wealth accumulates and men decay. I'm just thinking, for anyone seeking leadership in this country, and that phrase seems terribly relevant to now, is there some direction to be found in Tony Judd's writing?
I think there is. I think there are two things that really speak to our own situation. One is, and you know, this has been beautifully articulated by both of the previous speakers, but it's this sense that of realism, but of confronting reality, of never being afraid to identify reality, and at the same time not being defeated by it. You know, the figures he admires are obviously figures who do not get lost in abstractions, who do not get lost in the sort of rhetoric that leads to violence, but who at the same time have a moral passion to change the world around them. And of course he himself embodied that quite literally towards the end of his life. I mean, that extraordinary courage, that extraordinary sense of being both imprisoned and liberated. It's a brilliant image of how a public culture should face up to its own disasters. And I think more specifically, I think, you know, his evocation of that's what he calls the social democratic moment is incredibly important for us. You know, and it's incredibly important the way in which he roots that in not in the circumstances of great wealth and of wonderful prosperity, but in the circumstances of horror and destruction and despair that lay around the end of the Second World War. You know, at the very least, if you look at post-war again, you realise actually, you know, Ireland's problems are not that big, and that some of the solutions, which were built out of that horror, are solutions which are actually rooted morally in an idea that actually human life can be improved, and also rooted politically in the idea that there are enduring institutions which can actually add really profoundly to human well-being.
And that we can turn to literature and people like Goldsmith at times for lines of inspiration.
Precisely. I mean, you know, what's just wonderful about Judd is his mind, you know, and is that that refusal to be boxed into the kind of specialisms that Tim was talking about, you know, where things are not supposed to connect. I mean, he's a classic 20th century, indeed almost early 20th century intellectual in many ways, with that sense of connection. And that sense of connection is absolutely badly needed in our own circumstances.
Thanks to all of you. Professor Timothy Snyder, your latest book, Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, A History of German and Soviet Mass Killings, is out now. Vinton O'Toole, whose latest book, Enough is Enough, is published by Faber. The Memory Chalet by Tony Judd is published by Penguin. Robert Silvers, founding editor of the New York Review of Books, is staying with us to talk a little about that paper's rich history. I suppose many people, some anyway, here may be familiar with the origins of the review, but for those who are not, remind us of how it came to life back in 1963.
Well, the New York Review grew out of a very odd and unique and somewhat freaky situation. There was a long-standing strike in New York against the New York Times, and that included the New York Times Book Review. It was a lithographer's strike, a typographer's strike. And my friend Jason Epstein rang me one morning where I was an editor at Harper's Magazine. And I had published a marvelous essay on the decline of book reviewing by Elizabeth Hardwick, a wife of Robert Lowell, about the dreariness, the deadness, the mediocrity of much book reviewing in America, particularly in the New York Times. It caused a terrific stir. We thought of starting a book review. There was no money. Everyone said publishers would never advertise. And suddenly Jason rang up and said, "This is the only time in history we'll start a paper without a penny, because all the publishers are going crazy. They need a place to advertise it, to advertise. The books are inexorably coming out." And so I took a leave from Harper's. I joined with Jason's wife, Barbara, my partner for many years until she died about 8 years ago. And we asked the people we admired, the writers we admired most in the world, to contribute in 3 weeks with no pay reviews of books of the season. That included W.H. Auden. It included Norman Mailer, Bill Styron, Gore Vidal. Many famous writers all dropped their work. They all contributed. They all did it free. We put out a review in 4 weeks. It sold out immediately. That was the origin of New York Review. We then decided, since we put in a note saying, if you would like us to go on, tell us. We had 1,000 letters. With those letters, we were able to raise a little money. We started in earnest the next autumn. And the excitement of it was that these great writers had joined with us very, very enthusiastically and very freely to see what could be done to start a serious, a interesting, and intellectually demanding book review. And that's what happened.
And the first issue contained the only editorial you ever included, I think, saying you would abjure writing about books trivial in their intentions or venal in their effects, except occasionally to reduce a temporarily inflated reputation or call attention to a fraud. Does that still sum up your editorial philosophy?
I'm afraid that is the only editorial, and that's the only... we're still standing on that. And we are, perhaps we should be calling more attention to frauds, but we do it from time to time.
Going back to that first edition, almost 50 years ago, a different world, John F. Kennedy still in the White House. Remind us of the social and political context for what was that first issue and your ambitions for the publication.
Well, you know, Barbara and I were both editors. We both admired writers. I had been editor of the Paris Review in Paris, Paris editor. Barbara had worked on Partisan Review. I then went on to Harper's, where I published that famous essay of Lizzie's. We were essentially people who admired writers. We admired the people we thought were the most brilliant, the most talented writers in the world. And the idea was to give these writers a subject and a place and a space where they would feel they were reaching people interested in them. So that was the quintessence of what we did. We saw ourselves as essentially as admirers of great writing. And at the same time, of course, a book review can deal with and do anything, because there's a book on everything from bicycling to Buddhism to the a structure of the Communist Party. And so we found ourselves dealing with every sort of subject, trying to persuade the best writers we knew to deal with them. And we also felt, frankly, and we set the thing up this way, that we set it up so that the people who contributed money had no say. So Barbara and I had absolute freedom, as long as we could pay the printer's bill, to publish anything we wanted. Therefore, we had no compunctions whatever about any publisher, any conventional external force upon it. When we started out during the Kennedy administration, we published in our first regular article, a very skeptical article about intellectuals who had joined it, by Dwight MacDonald, one of the great humorous and serious writers of the time. Then Kennedy died, and we found ourselves facing the great convulsion of that time, the Vietnam War. We published article after article challenging the official version of it. We sent reporters to Vietnam, including Mary McCarthy, for example. And this was something that coincided with a great movement in the universities and among young people who had similar concerns and doubts and objections to that war. So this was, in our early years, a kind of dominating concern.
The politics of the New York Review of Books, you've been sharply political, as you say, left-leaning, often provocative. But as you say, too, there have always been articles questioning and critical of, we say, knee-jerk left-wing positions. How do you strike and maintain that balance?
Well, I think we look at things from the first, through the minds of the people we particularly respect, their arguments, their intellectual quality, their powers of expression. And so therefore, writers over the years like Isaiah Berlin or George Lichtheim or Tony Judd, who we thought had particular insight into the complexities of the political world, Hannah Arendt, who were independent of mind, who were not constricted by official and conventional obligations, who had a sense of intellectual traditions in the past. These sorts of minds were the ones we thought should be writing about current issues. And we tried to give them a chance. And often their views are very different, quite conflicting. And that was fine. The whole point of the review has been not to have some single discernible political line, but rather to give people who we thought were admirable in their moral, intellectual qualities a chance to say what they thought was the case. And that is really what we've tried to stick to.
Your first issue had a print run of 100,000 and sold out. And I think your subscriptions are now at about 137,000, meaning you're not dependent on advertising. Have you always felt secure financially as a publication?
Well, let me say that for the first 5 years, we didn't go into the black until the end of the first 5 years. We had another round of money raising. We always kept control. Around 1986, Ray Hedeman, who had been an owner of papers in Mississippi and also cable stations, offered to buy the Review, and on the condition that we would continue to have an guaranteed, absolute editorial control. And we sold the paper to him. He's kept that promise to us with absolutely. And so Barb and I were very privileged people. We, as editors, we probably had more editorial freedom and have more editorial freedom now that I'm alone than anyone probably in history of long-standing American journals. We've been able to do what we want, and we therefore, by the way, have no real excuses. The paper did start making money around the fifth year. It has continued to make some money ever since. Advertising is an important element in that. The University Presses of America do advertise in our pages, and we somehow have survived in the black ever since 1968.
You mentioned Barbara Epstein a few times there, and I suppose it's rare that two editors can work together so well as the two of you did, as you say, until her death in 2006. Over 40 years, how did that editorial relationship work, and was it difficult to keep going without her?
Well, I'll tell you that it was miraculous because we had been friends before, and we had a marvelous relation and rapport, and we both had writers we dealt with who we knew, and we at the same time, each of us read everything, went over everything that the other one had produced. So we collaborated very intensely, very closely. Amazingly, we had very little by way of disagreement. And above all, we had a great deal of fun. We really adored each other, and we saw the absurdity, the joke, the silliness of an awful lot that was going on. And so one could look forward to being with Barbara as a not only something we were working on, but something we were having a certain amount of fun doing.
And over the years, you've featured many of the finest Irish writers, both as reviewers and the reviewed, Seamus Heaney, John Banville, Conor Tobin, Edna O'Brien, and many others. And recently, you've had Ian Jack writing about the economic situation here, and indeed, you've had photos of empty new houses from my own home place in Leitrim. Is the Irish contribution reflective of the strength of Irish literature or the power of Irish America, or both?
Well, it goes back to what I originally said. It's a question of admiration of writers. It's a question of appreciating the particular power of the writing of Fenton, of Combe, of John Banville. These are marvelous critics, among the best in the world today, and the most, and with a kind of power in their prose and wit that we simply are drawn to. And so we found ourselves on the phone to Dublin or wherever, asking John Banville or Combe Toibin or Fenton to please help us, just because we admire their writing. And we don't think it, never thought of them in a particularly national or Irish way. We simply thought of them as terrific writers and reviewers.
I presume that there's a big archive of correspondence with the writers who work for you. That would be a unique and valuable resource for scholars of journalism and literature alike. Is that archive in one place?
Well, I'll tell you, there's something out in Brooklyn at the Navy Yard. There's a huge hall which has something called pallets, which are big boards. And on those pallets are literally, I suppose, many hundreds of boxes of my correspondence that had simply wheeled out there every year. And the universities have expressed interest in them. And I've never been out there, actually. And I haven't faced up to it. I haven't faced up to this vast amount of stuff with long correspondences with Noam Chomsky and Isaiah Berlin and all these people we published and admired. And I've been so caught up in trying to get out the paper. I haven't thought about the future. I haven't thought about what to do with all those papers. So one day I'll have to face up to it.
You've published most of the best writers in English from around the world. But looking back at the last 47 years or so, Is it the writers who stand out for you, or is it the memorable articles they've written, or sometimes the political events you've covered?
All three. That's the point of the review. It's a very various animal, as you indicated. We have marvelous criticism of poetry. It just, you know, we could do many books on our collections of our beautiful essays by people like Bill Merwin, Robert Lowell, and Helen Vendler, and Bill Empson, and Frank Kermode. We just stuck to poetry, and that would be one of of dozens of books. We have had a lot on such questions as China, Simon Leys, Pierre Ryckman, the Belgian writer who was in China, wrote The Emperor's Shadow and other books, exposing at a time of rather complacent admiration of China by many intellectuals. Simon Leys wrote a piece for us called The Walls of Beijing. And he showed how the city had been ruined by the communist state planners. And that was in the 60s, I believe. So we could have a whole book, and we have had books on our coverage of just China, Soviet Union, France, England, Africa, where Vidya Naipaul went to write on the Congo for us, and Helen Epstein, Barbara's daughter, has written the most brilliant articles on places like Ethiopia and Uganda. And so that we have a almost unmanageable series of subjects and writers over these 48 years. And we have indeed put out a number of collections of books from them. Just one of them was a collection called On Friendship, On Literary Friendship, Unforgettable Friends. Barbara and I edited it. It was, it contains memories of, by people like Mary McCarthy and Robert Penn Warren and a number of other writers of Norman Mailer, of people they knew and liked and had a feeling for, and they were fellow writers. And these were not nasty, catty, critical essays. They were, in some way, comradely appreciations. That's a little book that we did. It's not that little. And it just shows the kind of material that one could pluck from those archives.
Have you got to meet many of the writers you've admired and worked with over the years?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I have got to meet quite a few. But what strikes me, and has always struck me, is the dozens, and if not hundreds, who I have never met and have my own sort of fantasy vision of them, which often turns out to be quite misleading. But we have writers in many parts of England and in America and the West Coast and so on, who write for us very brilliantly. And I've never met them, but I deal with them by email, by telephone, whatever. And I feel I know them. But then there are some who have become very close friends of mine who are here in New York. And so it's just a very variable life with, you can imagine, in the autumn of each year, we'll have in every issue, let us say, 20, 22 articles by people from all over the world, really. I would say probably a good third or half of them I never met.
You've been at the helm for that almost 48 years now, a long time.
Yeah.
You seem completely engaged by the job of editing this paper you clearly love. I take it you have no plans to retire just yet.
No, you know, I was, when you say that, I was thinking, well, I've never been more engaged in anything. There's so much happening, so many things that one feels that we've got to do about American life and government and about the particular condition of things right now, that there's a real urgency, a real obligation to do better and to analyze more perceptively what's going on. So I feel all caught up in that.
And then, of course, there's the archive to attend to as well.
Yeah, one day I'll get out there.
Robert Silver, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
A pleasure to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Tonight's programme was produced by Sarah Binchy. From all of us, good night.